the Institute on Religious Life and the Daughters of St. Mary of Providence of Chicago bring you the third and last tape in a series of conferences given by Father John A. Hardin on the subject St. Francis of Assisi and the Witness to Evangelical Poverty. Father Hardin.
As I mentioned earlier, there's so much to talk about in speaking on Francis, but I thought we'd take one more chart, the analysis of Franciscan theology, and then stop there. Otherwise, we never go on to the others. By Franciscan theology, we mean, of course, the reflection on the faith as has been done over the centuries by the great masters of theology in the Franciscan order. So Franciscan theology is the theology of the Franciscans, but who have been true to the spirit of St. Francis. The four great names, always after St. Francis, that may be said to be the founders of Franciscan theology, of Alexander of Hales, who were the earliest, Blessed Raymond Lully, St. Bonaventure, and Duns Scotus. Among these four, St. Bonaventure, of course, towers above everyone, as most faithfully reflecting the mind of his own master, St. Francis. Why is it important to know Franciscan theology and not just what we have so far seen, say Franciscan spirituality, especially his poverty? The reason is the theology spans, in this case, seven centuries. 1221, the date of the first rule of Francis, but it's over 700 years since that rule was drafted. There have been many great minds, saints, men and women. The Franciscan calendar, just the list of all the blessed and saints, fills a book. Each one of whom added his or her own nuance and perspective. Secondly, it's one thing to hear about something concretely. It's something else to have the reflection on that. Theology is the reflection on the faith. Francis' insight into the person of Christ, especially Christ's humility, to be shown by my practice of poverty, is a concrete, personal, and sensibly perceptible experience. But theology reflects on that experience, analyzes it, and makes it intelligible, not only for practicing, but for understanding. And I think one of the greatest needs in religious communities today is not just more exhortations, but a clearer and deeper understanding. The theology reflecting on the spirit of St. Francis is rich. As I mentioned to you when we began this course, my first exposure for years was to St. Francis, long before I discovered Ignatius. My mother was a Franciscan tertiary, and without getting me in, she did the next best thing. And I just hope she's pleased with what I'm doing. She was a small woman. She had a very clear idea of when I was doing something wrong. In any case, I am teaching theology. All the theology I've taught for 25 years has been colored by St. Francis. First, the basis of Franciscan theology is St. Augustine. Francis was no great litterateur. He was literate, of course. He was a profoundly intelligent man. He was no student of St. Augustine. But without having studied Augustine, he imbibed the spirit of Augustine, which has especially three features. In Francis, as in Augustine, there was a preoccupation with God's sovereignty, with God's running this world. God's in charge, have no doubt. This is God's world. That's Augustine. That's Francis. Augustine couldn't have given another name to his greatest work except the City of God. And second, in Augustine, as in Francis, a profound awareness of human sinfulness. Now, Augustine on this level had experiences that Francis knew not of. Augustine had drunk deeply of the chalice of sin. He was a sinner, and a real one. When Augustine wrote about sin, he wrote from experience. Francis, unlike Augustine, was no great sinner. Though if you read Francis' own writings, you think he was worse than Judas. But Francis has much to teach us. Because while Augustine understood sin in a way that Francis never could, and he was the better for it, but Francis had an awareness of man's sinfulness and of the least deviation from the will of God, especially interior deviation. I don't know of any great saint whose conscience was so sensitized to God's will as that of Francis, as a result of which he really meant it when he said he was the greatest sinner on earth. He meant it. He really was. In his own eyes, he really was. And thirdly, and logically, if I am such a sinner, then I need grace. I need grace to be forgiven my sins. I need grace to expiate my sins. I need grace to avoid sin. And this is the incredible awareness of man's total helplessness and of God's power that Francis revealed to the world. Second, voluntarism. The word itself is technical, as we shall see when we look at St. Dominic and Dominican spirituality. It may be characterized as intellectualism, not Francis. For Francis, though of course he recognized that man is a composite of mind and will, of intellect and volition, of a capacity for knowledge and a capacity for love. But with Francis, all the weight was on the side of the will, of the affections, of love. Never to the exclusion of the intellect, but certainly emphasizing the role of the will. What are the implications? First, the primacy of the will. For Francis, it matters little, frankly, how much I know about God. It matters a lot how much I love God. Now, part of my love of God will be that I will want to know more about God. But even there, it's only that I might love Him more. Moreover, surprisingly, for a man who so stressed the absolute need of grace, Francis was terrifyingly aware of the power of human freedom. So I need grace. So I do. But even the Almighty, as incredible as it may seem, even the Almighty cannot save me, let alone sanctify me, unless I want to. I hold in my hands my own destiny. Then Francis stressed the freedom of the will. By freedom, of course, he meant, first and most importantly, internal freedom. That, as I have so often said, we can be in prison without being behind bars. In other words, freedom from our passions, freedom from unruly desires, freedom from inordinate fears. Free from myself, free from that part of me that would enslave the better part of me. And why be free? In order that I might love God more. But freedom of the will also, in that I will be beholden to no one. This, as we saw earlier, was one of the main reasons for his insistence on poverty. All I know, and I know it, that rich people are not free people. They have at least one terrifying fear, and that is of losing their wealth. Third, and we need not dwell on this except to state it, primacy of poverty in the pursuit of holiness. As you can see, not only in the time that I spent on poverty and the raising of the volume that I noticed I occasionally did in speaking on the subject, there is no question that unless we look to our poverty, the pursuit of holiness is the pursuit of a dream. The prominence of the Blessed Virgin. First, Francis himself had a very tender personal devotion to Our Lady. No doubt one reason was that he was so aware of Christ's humanity. He was the one, as you know, who gave the modern world its great devotion to Christmas. And not just the Christmas crib, but Christmas. And one reason, be it said, remember these two dates. Oh, I can use this for, let me. Two dates. That we should keep in mind. The major heresy that the Fourth Lateran Council condemned in 1215 was the heresy of Albigensianism. The heresy that seduced something upwards of 1,000 major cities in Europe. Seems to have been a large part of Europe. In fact, the highest peak of holiness reached by the perfecti among the Albigenses was to die of starvation by self-inflicted suicide. In other words, well, that's not easy to commit suicide. I don't suggest trying it, I'm just saying it's a painful process to starve yourself. Talk about being misguided. We miss, or would miss, one of the principal thrusts of Francis and why God raised a man like him. You can see I'm no Albigensian. Francis' stress on Christ's poverty was that we are to use this world's goods, but use them according to the will of God. But his stress on Our Lady was to make sure that no one made any mistake, that God became man and was born of a woman, that God had a mother, in order to emphasize for all times what the Church wants us to be so clear in believing, that God took on real human flesh, and that as a consequence, that humanity of Christ is adorable, that humanity of Christ is imitable, that humanity of Christ is lovable, and that when I love Jesus, I am loving God, though the one I love, from all external evidence, is a human being. When Francis talked about Christ, for example, I'm sure you've read it, how much you've read of the omnibus, but he would tell his followers, and he would be lost in ecstasy at the bright sun overhead. To think of it, the same sun that is warming us warmed Jesus. The water that we're drinking is the water that God took. The food we eat, the earth we walk on, the air we breathed was breathed by God. You can see why his great devotion to Our Lady was to make clear to all who inherited his spirit that the God they are worshiping is a God who is a man being born, as the rest of us are, of a woman. Union with God through meditation, prayer, and contemplation. With all the far-flung and breathtaking apostolic achievements that those in the Franciscan tradition, no matter what their community may have been, have achieved in 7 centuries, might obscure the main purpose that Francis had in, well, leading people to Christ. The main purpose was that they might, by following Christ, the via, might learn Christ, the veritas, and possess Christ, the vita. Christ, therefore, is the way. He is the way to the possession of Christ, and the only way we can speak of possessing Christ is possessing him, as Augustine said, preceding Francis, possessing him with the 2 arms of our spirit, the arms of the mind and the heart, or the intellect and the will. Now the means towards this possession of God were, and Francis emphasized this, as few other founders of religious institutes did, through meditation, prayer, and contemplation. What's the difference? I'm now using Francis' vocabulary. Meditation is thinking about God. Prayer is asking God, invoking God. And contemplation is looking at God, whom I love. So meditation is using the intellect. Not much, but using it. Prayer is asking God. And contemplation then is, as the word implies, looking at, beholding, the one whom I love. Christian perfection for Francis was contemplative love. And by now centuries of theology have excavated the meaning of that. This, as we shall see, is not quite the language of Saint Ignatius. For Ignatius, who was not a soldier for nothing, and of course, when Ignatius fought, the principal enemies would be who? Who would you think? The world, the flesh, and the devil. So if Ignatius were to define Christian perfection is victory over the world, flesh, and the devil. Now, Francis would not deny that. But Francis was no soldier. Not at least in Ignatius' sense. For Francis, we become as perfect as we grow in contemplative prayer. A great deal of what is now being written about in so many volumes can be seen very clearly once you realize what some of these things meant for the men, in this case Francis, or women, as later on in the case of, say, Teresa of Avila. Some of the deepest problems in theology can be resolved once you see how these people understood them. You are as perfect as you love God. That's it. Stress on the mystical over acquired knowledge. In Franciscan theology, therefore, they did not deny, nor do the Franciscans say today, who write in their tradition, deny that there is a great deal we can and should learn by study and dint of our own human effort to know God and His mind and will better than we do. But in the Franciscan tradition, the principal source is not study, but prayer.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.